I'm Finian Cunningham. I'm an independent freelance journalist writing on various international issues and relations. I've just completed a four-week trip of China and Korea, South Korea, wanted to look at the Belt and Road Initiative projects up close and see for myself what the claims are made for and against these projects. And I think I got some good insights into how they're rolling out presently and over the next few years towards making China and its regional neighbours a very, very powerful driving force for the global economy.
Right. Well, it's not quite the Burma Railway, as we know from things like the Bridge on the River Kwai. You know, the idea of Western colonialism trying to sort of bring, because the railway, of course, was back in the British Empire days, a major force, not only here in Britain, for allowing the armaments and all of the tools of empire to be assembled as efficiently as possible and moved around. But it's something which it's a very simple, basic form of transport. It's a public transport, in other words, so not everyone has to have their own train. And I just wondered, in your trip, so how long has it taken and where have you been? How many miles have you been travelling around?
Well, I particularly visited the southwestern province of China called Hunan, and that borders with Myanmar, Laos, and Vietnam. Down were known as the Golden Triangle of notoriety, and there is the centerpiece of the Pan-Asian railway network that China has invested billions of dollars in to integrate its neighboring countries, those I mentioned, plus also Thailand, Cambodia, Malaysia, and Singapore. So this railway network, this Pan-Asian rail network, is very much an embodiment of the whole Belt and Road Initiative that China launched about 9 years ago, and which is spanning the globe, but very much centered in the Southeast Asian region. And the southwestern province of China, called Hunan, is a vital link into this giant mega project, this railway project.
So how far have you actually travelled on these trains?
Well, I boarded the train, what they call the China-Laos rail link, and the link to Laos from China complements the similar rail links to those other countries, Myanmar, Vietnam, Thailand, Cambodia, and Malaysia, and Singapore. So the China-Laos link I travelled on was about 500 kilometres. That's only a fraction of the overall breadth and scope of this Pan-Asian rail network. It's going to cover something like 30,000 kilometres, in which will link up 8 countries, primarily China and the others. Now, it's still under construction, largely. I mean, the China-Laos rail link has been completed. It's in operation this year. The other countries will, over the next few years, up till 2030, are scheduled to complete their rail links. And we're talking about high-speed and conventional-speed railways, plus motorways. I mean, it's a huge, ambitious project led by China to integrate all those regional economies in what China would call a win-win mutual co-development partnership. That's the Chinese philosophy or vision for the BRI. They keep repeating it, this win-win philosophy of partnership and mutual development. And this is what's underway in the Southeast Asian region in the form of this Pan-Asian rail network.
Right. Well, I mean, these are areas, I mean, with Burma, Myanmar now, and Vietnam in the past, and many other of these countries have been actually the subject of, I mean, Vietnam particularly, the most horrific war probably since World War II, and protracted, and very obviously to do with empire and imperialist war. The other aspect of the Western interest over there, of course, many people don't know about, but it's quite clear was to do with opium and the control of the drug supplies of that region, which they took over from French Indochina, the Americans did. So, I mean, this does sound to me as if, you know, it's kind of trying to get rid of differences. It's almost as if the North Vietnamese won, Finian. And actually, after all that fighting, the people would much rather have economic ties with a powerful regional neighbour than the so-called freedom to do delivered by the United States.
Mm. Yeah. Well, you mentioned the historical background there about the French and the British imperialists trying to but failed to construct railway networks in that region. And it was all very self-serving to extract the natural resources out of those countries to, export them all back to Britain and France. And the Japanese imperialists tried to build a railway road that you mentioned there, the notorious Road of Death from Thailand to Myanmar. The Americans left, I mean, such an atrocious legacy of destruction in that region with its war in Vietnam that also embroiled, you know, neighbouring countries, Laos and Cambodia, just left an absolute trail of destruction. China's coming at it with a wholly different concept, one of co-development, partnership, mutual economic development, good neighborliness, win-win philosophy. I mean, this is completely different from anything that the Europeans and the Americans ever attempted, in that part of the world. And bringing together a genuine spirit of mutual development. I mean, one of the terrible ironies that I encountered in this trip, Tony, was that, I mean, China, in building these railway networks, a lot of the effort has involved clearing unexploded American bombs left over from the Vietnam War, that horrible period from 1964 to 1975. And the Americans carpet bombed Vietnam, but also Laos and Cambodia, secretly, criminally, scattered those countries with millions of bombs, 260 million bombs in Laos alone. Laos, tiny Laos that borders Vietnam, the country that is now the first real link from China in this
Which
plantation.
They weren't even supposed to be at war with.
Yeah, and part of took China and Laos 5 years to build this rail link, this China-Laos rail link. It's now complete after 5 years. It took $7 billion worth of construction. And part of that effort, that huge engineering effort to build tunnels, to build bridges over the Mekong River, fabulous structures, by the way, part of that huge effort involved preparatory clearing of the whole region or the country, the mountainous terrain, of American unexploded ordnance. I mean, this kind of, it really illustrates in that one, aspect alone, the complete difference in China's economic vision and relations with the region compared with the American legacy and prior to that, the British and French and imperialist and Japanese imperialist legacy. And it's really bitterly ironic how the Western media, and particularly the American media, try to relentlessly undermine China's efforts of partnership with its neighbours. I mean, publications like the Radio Free Asia, RFI, the Voice of America, VOA, are continually alleging that various negative aspects of China's partnerships with its neighbours and this railway network in particular. I mean, the Radio Free Asia continually alleges without much evidence that this rail network is damaging the ecology, it's displacing local farming communities. I mean, it's really richly and bitterly ironic that you've got an American publication casting aspersions on China's what I could see as a very prosperous and mutually beneficial project. They're trying to cast aspersions on this, and this is coming from a country that has left a legacy of horror in that region in terms of the destruction from bombs and Agent Orange defoliation, the huge legacy of disease and birth defects. And the bombing alone in Laos killed 50,000 Laotian civilians, never mind 3 million in Vietnam. So for the Americans and their publications to try to denigrate what China's doing with the claims of ecological damage and displacement of communities, the human impact, I mean, it really is quite absurd and grotesque for what they're attempting to smear China with.
Well, look, I mean, the fact is America is far, far away from there, and China is very close by. I mean, it's quite clear, surely, that it's different that the Americans don't have the influence in the region. They wanted the influence in the region, and I mean, I understand that the legacy from Agent Orange and the defoliation program, which was basically designed to stop the North Vietnamese during the Vietnam War being able to grow their own food and this sort of thing, and to poison the earth so that that nothing would grow. They also used it to try and destroy forests, massive areas of forest, in order to give the North Vietnamese less places to hide. But their attitude to the ecology, of course, was absolutely appalling. But you know, this is in China's backyard, Finian. I mean, the Chinese are bound to want to bolster their support from their neighbours, and they may be the Chinese may be a bit further afield, being a little bit more aggressive in their plans for expansion.
Well, I don't know, Tony. I think that's kind of always a very pejorative and questionable premise that, this is aggressive expansion. I mean, do people accuse the European Union of aggressive expansion because it expands its membership eastwards? I mean,
Well, yes, they do. I think quite rightly, actually, yeah.
Well, I mean, not in the same kind of derogatory way, I think, that China's always accused of. But China's putting out a quite open platform of the Belt and Road Initiative being a win-win, neighbourly, mutual concept and partnership in action. And, I mean, when the Western media accuse China of using all sorts of, expansionism and trying to, harbour a plan for domination, they never, if ever, consult the neighbouring countries. I mean, Laos welcomed this new rail link, the China-Laos Railway, and other regional countries are participating in it willingly. I just ask you, I mean, on your listeners, I mean, when do you ever hear the Western media quoting these neighbouring countries with who presumably the Western media would make out have got a problem with China's alleged expansion? I mean, if the Western media were actually fair about covering these developments, the BRI, they would consult these countries. And if they did, well, the Laos president is on record on the opening of that rail link a few months ago. He's on record of welcoming it as a new era of regional development. So you know, the Western media claims or allegations are often groundless and very much unilaterally asserted. They never, that I can see, consult the actual countries concerned and ask them, well, what is your view of China? As I say, the Laotian president welcomed it, and they seemed to be very, very much willing and participating in it, and realize that they stand to benefit greatly from closer integration of the economies, and with the world's second biggest economy, China. It's they're evidently of the view that this is a win-win solution. So who is the West? What right has the West got to interpolate itself and to try to fracture relations and kind of divide and rule effectively? I mean, the Vietnam War, Tony, if I can just come back to that. I mean, one could analyze that whole horror as being driven by the United States being absolutely dead against, opposed any kind of independent post-colonial development. Vietnam, won its independence from colonial France, and the Americans, as with many other decolonizing countries, couldn't abide the idea that there could be new independent countries, and it went to war in Vietnam with all sorts of pretexts about curbing the spread of world communism. But really, in my view, and I think for a lot of other historians and analysts, the Vietnam War really represented the American agenda to have hegemony, to have control, to have domination, to prevent any kind of independent development of countries. So they went to war and they destroyed Vietnam, or tried to destroy Vietnam, and committed a genocidal war of 3 million people being killed, and the neighboring countries. So again, the same mentality is extant today. The Americans just cannot abide any kind of global development that's outside of their control, that's outside of their capitalist domination of those economies. So when China is engaged with it in what appears to be a very mutual development plan with its neighbors, the Americans are motivated to try to undermine that by casting all sorts of aspersions about allegations of, China expansionism, the real network damaging ecology, displacing communities, and very little evidence to support that. It's very much...
You've just been on this train. Just take us through the experience. First of all, I mean, it's looking as if, I'm not sure of the final total, thousands of miles of railways around that whole region of the world. Mm. And can you just tell us what the experience was like? And also, I mean, what the fares are like, for example? And what about, are they using overhead wires? Because, I don't know this is really even part of this discussion debate, but there's this whole decision being made. I mean, we had a horrific problem here in the UK recently with overhead wires, and it does seem as if, if you're going to try and transmit power all the way along on overhead wires, you're going to be costing a lot more, and you're going to have a lot more downtime on the railway. So is it overhead wires? And also, what's the ride like, and what does it cost?
Yeah, the real service I was on, it was electrified, but there was no overhead lines. I don't know. I'm not technically.
That's good. Look, I'm just saying that's very, very, very good, and it's sensible, because these overhead things, it's basically a kind of contract scam whereby the railway, once you get those, will cost about three or four times more to maintain, and the contractors rub their hands. So it's good to hear the Chinese have done that. But was the train crowded? What were the fares like, Finian?
Busy, I boarded the train in Xuxuangbanna, a city down, Chinese city down on the border, traveled up to Kunming, 500 kilometers north back into China. Everything seemed to be very efficiently run. I've experienced Korean railway network, which is world famous, and I could say that the Chinese, the China Laos link was very, you know, comparable in terms of its efficiency and modern.
Yeah, but look, I'm looking for the comfort side of it. You know, lots of leg room. You know, what sort of services involved, that sort of thing.
Well, it was a short, relatively short trip. I can't remember. Yes, I've availed of some refreshments. It was very comfortable, smooth, silent, ride. Went through some beautiful countryside, rolling green hills, perhaps even jungle, you could call the terrain. And I have to say, there was no evidence to my eyes of any ecological damage left by the construction of this rail line. This is what the American media, like Radio Free Asia, are continually alleging, that these projects are inflicting massive, widespread damage on virgin forest or virgin jungle. I didn't see any evidence of giant scar, areas being scarred or left disturbed. It was beyond the very real track.
Okay, so look, you're going 500 kilometers or so, you say, which is, what is it, about 300 miles. How much does that cost you on this Belt and Road train?
I think with the exchange rate, it probably would work out about 20 euro for that trip. It was very busy, you know, when I got on it, but, you know, not in a, you know, chaotic way. People had I remarked that the train station resembled something like an airport. People were, went up. Everything is very electronically transacted in China now. You know, there's no kind of mad rushing around looking for seats. Everybody's allocated seat by booking. Harmoniously.
What happens if you sit in the wrong seat? You get into trouble.
I have to say, you know, my impression of Asian culture and Chinese culture in particular, people are very stoic, very polite. There's no argy-bargy and arguing about things. It's all done in a very civilized and respectful way, and no need for any kind of...
Are you allowed to pay in cash, that sort of thing?
I'm not sure about if you can, but a lot of times people pay now just with their cards or with their phone.
Yeah. Well, they do here, Finian, but I think most people are aware that China is going very fast towards this kind of cashless world, isn't it?
Yeah, a lot of transactions were, you know, cash seemed to be old hat or kind of a bit archaic. Everybody was very comfortably and proficiently using what appeared to be, you know, phones, just tap using their phones to, like, a credit card. But I do have to emphasize, Tony, from what I could say, I mean, we're talking about in total, this Pan-Asian rail network is going to cover 30,000 kilometers. Now, I only saw a small fraction of that, 500 kilometers or so, and some associated motorways that are under construction. I have to say, from what I saw, there wasn't anything remotely resembling what is alleged in the Western media about environmental destruction and
social. But what about? I'm looking at other aspects of what's going on in China, because it's fascinating, yeah, you know, to have this opportunity to chat to you. I mean, things like COVID passes. What we hear over here is that there's still this kind of zero COVID policy in China, where COVID is long gone, and, you know, anyone to get around, they've got to have apparently a COVID pass. I don't know if that's still operating, or you had to have something like that. And also the there are various aspects to Chinese life, such as the idea that, well, you know, it's only if your social credit score is a certain level that you're even allowed to use one of these trains.
I didn't see anything that's a new one to me, you know, that claim, but I didn't see anything like that. I mean, it seemed to be a very popular and popularly available a form of transport. People, from my observations, were from all walks of life. You know, it wasn't in any ways, if that's what you're suggesting, it's sort of an elitist mode of travel. It was a public transport system that's very, very efficiently run.
Well, you see, sometimes this is Western propaganda, isn't it? You know, we have we have to be quite careful to try and find out what the real China's like, and it's brilliant to have this opportunity to talk to you about that. Can you just, you know, obviously having spent a while in China there, just give us your flavour as an Irishman of, you know, the differences in lifestyle, and also, you know, what people's daily routines are like, cafes, that sort of thing.
Yeah. I found it a very pleasant experience of China, indeed. I mean, we hear a lot of negative claims in the Western media about China. And my experience of being there for 3 weeks in that country, another week elsewhere, but 3 weeks in China, my experience completely negated, in a very pleasant way, a lot of claims that are made in the Western media. People, you know, live together in a very harmonious, civilized way, and their infrastructure is something to behold. I mean, the roadways, city planning that I saw was absolutely astounding in its, you know, achievement of very convenient, modern, efficient lifestyle, and people to be able to get around. A lot of the cities had a lot of green spaces and very clean, very well designed, and I had to, in my own mind, contrast it with conditions in Europe, where there's a lot of poverty and social breakdown and appearances of collapse in infrastructure.
Are you saying you don't see signs of poverty, like begging or anything like that?
Tony, I assure you, I didn't see any such, pathetic scenes of, horrible inequality and deprivation while in China. In fact, it was remarkable how wholesome and salubrious the conditions were. I mean, I was looking out for what I thought might be evidence of marginalized communities living in very squalid or broken down ghetto type areas that you often see in Europe and in my own country, Ireland. And I couldn't find any such description. I mean, I saw some very fantastic skyscraper apartments and apartments that were, I was informed, were for ordinary modest income earning families, and it all looked very neatly put together. You know, of course, there was it wasn't all monotonous and uniform. I mean, there were variations in kind of how some apartments looked to be more fancily appointed than others, but generally all very neatly done. The accommodation was very well organized by the Chinese government, what they claim, of course, is a communist society, a socialist society. But I didn't see, and I truly mean this, I didn't see any pathetic scenes of deprivation and social marginalization and really squalid, poor housing that you often see in Europe. Everything seemed to be very well organized and very deliberately planned to create a decent society for.
Well, I mean, so obviously something very different is happening in China to what is happening in Europe. I mean, I think it's in it Michael Hudson that's he's written this book recently. I don't know if you've come across it, called The Evolution of Civilization, and I think that maybe it's not evolution, The Destiny of Civilization. That's right. Finance capitalism, industrial capitalism, or socialism? And in there, he's saying basically what's going on in Ukraine is not a war of some sort between the eastern countries of China, Russia, and the Shanghai Cooperation Agreement countries, and NATO, that is mainly Europe and the United States. That isn't really what this behind this. What's behind it is a war between two systems. One is the mixed economy, where you have a government which arranges its infrastructure to facilitate economic growth and the quality of life of its population, and the West, which sees everything as finance capitalism rules. Basically, money rules. Money buys political parties, money buys influence, money buys the press, the media, etc. And that's what Hudson says is really going on.
I think I would tend to agree with that description. I mean, China and its Asian neighbours appear to me very much going for a rationally planned economy for the greater good, the greater good of society. And from what I could tell, they are achieving it. They're achieving it admirably and delivering on creating a better society where people can live in decent housing with decent transport and all very much under the auspices of a planned system. Now, we could call that socialism, but it's a very much a rational plan, centrally planned system that, in my encounter with China, was remarkably successful. And I mean, I couldn't see anything that would could substantiate the claims that are made in the Western media that very much try to smear China's development plan.
Well, there's a tremendous amount of nonsense in the Western media, I think, as anybody with more than half a brain cell can figure out. I mean, a lot of it is just becoming is becoming propaganda. I just wonder, I mean, I brought up Ukraine.
As you say, Tony, that referring to Michael Hudson's book, and I do admire Hudson for his analysis on things and his command of global economics. I think there is a war going on. I mean, this is an ideological war, but the West and Biden, the American president, would call it democracy versus autocracy. Autocracy. That's his pejorative narrative. But there is a war. I think a struggle for between the West, the dying, waning West, and to try to prevent the emergence of a multipolar world, one that I think is manifested or embodied by China and its neighbours in this mutual spirit of co-development and partnership. And the West are desperately trying to prevent that from taking place because it completely undermines their vision of hegemony and unipolar control under
the irony is, Finian, that the up until the Thatcher Reagan era, I mean, really from before 1980, both the US and Europe seemed to believe in that idea of a mixed economy, didn't they?
Yeah. Yes, well, I suppose, when the chips are down and the empire is feeling its age, it's becoming more desperate in trying to thwart any kind of competitor or what it calls geopolitical rival. I mean, the West is always, articulating this in a very hostile way, and a Cold War kind of a mentality of divide and divisive struggle. China and other countries are always emphasizing the collective, the cooperative spirit, the mutual spirit, the multipolar spirit. It's the West that's very much inflaming tensions and antagonism. And that's the way they operate. That's the way American and European imperialism before it operates. It must conquer and subjugate as opposed to cooperate. and China is very much contradicting the paradigm of Western domination that has been extant for the last few centuries.
No, you're right. But look, what about, you know, there is one point, I think, which extremely important point, which I think the West and people like Klaus Schwab, Prince Charles, sorry, King Charles, I've got a point, which is cities like Beijing, where you've got a, you know, some people even take oxygen around with them. I mean, it's an impossible, and it's a completely disgusting environment to have to work in, isn't it? I mean, very few people here in the West would want to go move out to a job in a city where you've got to wear an oxygen mask because of the pollution levels.
Well, I've heard about this notorious pollution problem in Beijing.
It's not every day, but you know, the idea is you don't want to sort of look out the window and so you can hardly see the other tower blocks around you, and you know, there is a serious pollution problem, isn't there? I mean, this is surely part and parcel, a bit like the old London smogs, of becoming an industrial country.
Well, I've heard about this environmental pollution in Beijing. I wasn't in Beijing on this trip, Tony. I mean, I'd like to go back and see Beijing and that part of China for myself. So I can't really comment on what is said about the pollution problems. I think the Chinese government are very much well aware of ecological problems with industrialization, and from what I can tell, are trying to mitigate it or to manage it as best as possible. They're certainly not just recklessly build, and to hell with the environment. They're very mindful of the long term consequences for their nation, their people's well-being, and so I think there could be a little bit of a Western stereotype there of you know.
Well, hang on. Are you saying it's not happening? Because it quite clearly is happening.
Yes. Well, I'm not saying that, Tony, but I'm saying that it's not as if China is not aware of that or is not doing anything about it. I mean, the cities I saw, Guangzhou, Kunming, and other cities, I mean, I couldn't see any detrimental, horrible environmental pollution. In fact, the cityscapes were very clean, and the atmosphere seemed to be perfectly normal and you know, clean. So I'm sure, of course, like Beijing, you know, the pictures we've seen of smog, you know, no doubt there was problems with any industrializing nation encounters problems. You mentioned London, the smog, and look at London today and Paris today, you know, covered in clouds of you know, filth and noxious gases, noxious pollutants. Every country has a problem with industrialization. To single out China alone is just, I think, betrays an anti-China mentality that and a double standard, you know. To and as I say, China, from what I could tell, the Chinese government are very much trying to come, you know, mitigate it and to deal with it to kind of relieve it.
Okay. What about a part of the world which you know very well, which is Tigray? I know you were living over in Ethiopia for a while. Can you just give us your appraisal of what's been going on there? Because I know that, I mean, for example, that part of the world has been having a tremendous series of droughts, most likely caused by, you know, alterations in the climate, and maybe even caused by China. Who knows? But anyway, you know, from the pollution. But the point being that there's, although there's lots of talk about, you know, aid going to countries that have been affected by climate, paid for by the West and the developed countries, almost none has made it anywhere near round to that region to help people who are now suffering almost like every other year droughts that maybe would come every 20 years. And so, but on top of all that, then there's the Ethiopian war in Tigray. I wonder if you could just maybe in a nutshell explain some of the causes of that and some of the real powers involved and you know, where you think that's going.
Well, it's heartrending what's happening in Ethiopia. I mean, 2 years now there's been a war, a full-on war directed at the northern Tigray region. And just recently, airstrikes by the central regime, the Abiy Ahmed, who won the Nobel Peace Prize laughably 4 years ago. His regime have struck just this past week civilian centers in Tigray region and killed dozens of civilians. I mean, what's going on there is just an absolute despicable genocidal war by his regime against the Tigray population. This population, over 6 million people in the Tigray region in northern Ethiopia. And it's just absolutely abominable that this regime, this Ethiopian regime, are imposing a siege on the region of Tigray, where food, electricity, normal daily services like banking, water supply, food supplies, transport, are blockaded. And the 6 million population of Tigray are being left to die from chronic starvation, chronic cut off of medicines to the population, and the Western governments, the European Union, the Americans are very indifferent towards the plight of those people. Now they now and again they make some kind of token urging of the Ethiopian government to relieve the siege, to let in humanitarian aid. But it's all very much done with kid gloves. They don't care. They're really indifferent to what's going on in Ethiopia. And this is where I think their response to Ukraine or their purported concerns about Ukraine are really exposed as being just hypocritical double standards. They're interested in Ukraine, or they appear to be interested in the plight of people in Ukraine, because it suits their political agenda to confront Russia. I mean, if they were really motivated by principle, humanitarian principles, they would be equally, they would be animated and very outspoken about what's happening in Ethiopia's Tigray region, which they are not. Now, what is it all about? I think what's happened in Ethiopia is that it's an American agenda to displace China. China, for over 20 years, was a very beneficial partner, strategic partner to Ethiopia, as it is increasingly with Africa. And Ethiopia was certainly a prime example of how China was bringing its BRI, Belt and Road Initiative, partnerships to Africa. We've mentioned Southeast Asia before, but Africa is where the BRI is also very much being implemented. Now, the Americans and the Europeans can't abide this venture by China into the continent of Africa, formerly their colonial stomping ground. And I think what happened in Ethiopia is that the Americans very much have engineered a change of government there, which brought in this Abiy Ahmed, who from my knowledge and from my sources, very much implicated as a CIA asset. He was brought into power, and The immediately, apart from winning the Nobel Peace Prize, which was a bit of a charade anyway, he launched his war on the Tigray region. This is all about wrecking Ethiopia. I mean, Ethiopia as a state, it's got a population of about 115, 120 million, the second most populous nation in Africa. And in 3 years from the onset of this war, 2 years especially, the last 2 years, but there was a war built up to this war the year before when I was living in Ethiopia, and I can verify that. In 3 years, that country has been brought to its knees. I mean, it was one of the star economic performers in the whole of Africa for many years, with the Chinese partnership of China and investment and development of infrastructure. And in the space of 3 years, Ethiopia has just completely collapsed into just a misery, a charnel house. Now, it's not just in the Tigray region. The whole country, it's not very much reported in the media, but the whole country, north, west, east and south, has been thrown into turmoil by this new regime that I believe the Americans very much fomented, and with the purpose of destroying Ethiopia's independence and its independent economic growth that it had gained through a strategic partnership with China. The agenda here, Tony, was to destroy Ethiopia, and sadly, lamentably, that's been quite well achieved, the destruction of Ethiopia, which the war in Tigray is just a manifestation of.
Right. Amazing. Well, look,
I mean, yeah. I know I've said a lot there, and I would need to go back and pick through it, and I could substantiate it, but you know, the various things that I've said there. I mean, it's quite sad, but some people in the Western left, the Western so-called anti-imperialist left, have got the story all back to front. They're claiming that the Americans are using the Tigray somehow to undermine Ethiopia's independence. I mean, it's a very distorted, perverse way of analysing what's happened in Ethiopia. I mean, the Americans are not using the Tigray region whatsoever. I mean, they have used the Abe regime, this incumbent so-called prime minister, as their battering ram on that country. And currently there's an attempt to have a bit of a peace process, driven by the African Union. But it remains to be seen what can be salvaged out of this very fragile dialogue that's, you know, aimed at, you know, achieving some sort of peace. But the country has been destroyed in 3 years, and that's absolutely abominable.
No, it is. And it's interesting to hear. Very important insight there, really, into the geopolitics of all of this. I mean, we've had a bit more geopolitics, Finian, if you don't mind me pressing you on this one, over the last few weeks with the new Liz Truss Kamikwazi Kwarteng government. And it's the message which was sent by their mini budget the beginning of last week to the markets is unbelievable, really. We've seen roughly 20-25% disappear off of markets around the world, stock markets, as a result of this. Now, I wonder, because you know, it seems amazing to me that such a, you know, so-called independent elected decision by the Conservative membership can send such shockwaves economically around the world. And you know, this we're talking here about, you know, many tens or hundreds of billions of people's investment has just disappeared because of an announcement in London. And I don't know if, I mean, have they just lost the plot?
Tony, I'm not the best person to comment on that, really, because I've been out of the country out of that part of Europe for nearly 4 weeks now. So I do appreciate what you're saying is very significant development and very sinister, but I'm not the person to make any kind of expert judgment or call on on that? You know, you sound as if you know a lot more than.
Well,
than
look, I'm just, I mean, I suppose underlying my question is there seems to be, you know, the Western economies. I mean, it's very interesting to get your take on China, which seems very stable. Mm-hmm. I've also heard from one of my contacts over there recently that they are in China absolutely prepared for a nuclear war. That they have a lot of these in the big shopping centres. They have quite subtle kind of nuclear bunkers in there and the basements of a lot of the big tower blocks, etc. So there, you know, if there is some sort of nuclear alert, the Chinese government are prepared to defend their civilian population, and not obviously here in the West at all. But I mean, that's the nuclear brink, but there seems to be a sort of economic brink as well, which, what's that?
Okay. Sorry, that was just a little you know, fan there, Tony. Okay, that I had
right. All right, so just here. Pause for a second.
Yeah.
Yeah, I say, well, so we seem to, Tony, be on some sort of economic brink, you know, and I wonder what your take on that is, because the Chinese are doing really well. As you said, the Western countries are scrabbling. It's almost as they're scrabbling around for ideas to try and keep their credibility, but they seem to be also losing it fast, as we've seen over the last couple of weeks.
Yeah. Well, I mean, my take on that, Tony, is I think we're seeing the death throes of Western capitalism. I mean, the Western economies are just an implosion, you know, dynamic, and the debt situation in the United States has again hit another record level. You look at the societies in Britain and across Europe, it's one of like a third worldization process. And I think this is the Western capitalist system is very much going down the tubes. And with that, you have all sorts of desperate flights of, crazy politics and infighting and, desperately trying to shore up a collapsing house of cards. And part of that, I think, is to kind of flirt with, war, and to try to, war is always a way of salvaging the failures of capitalism, as we've seen in two previous world wars and other international conflicts. War is always a good solution to regenerate your deadbeat capitalist economy. And I think that's what's going on. It's quite, to me, evident that the West is desperately failing, and is in that desperation is a very dangerous condition of trying to incite wars and to regenerate their economies through militarism. I have to say, Tony, you mentioned China there. I did not detect any concern in China among the people that I met or were talking to about American war threats. They're well aware of the antagonism that Washington is deliberately provoking over Taiwan and outrageously interfering in China's sovereign interests with Taiwan and previously Hong Kong. But the Chinese, from what I can see, were very much getting on with their lives, getting on with their very successful economy, their economic planning, and they weren't unduly perturbed or spooked by the reckless Americans and their NATO and Australian partners in crime. That's to say, they're not complacent, they're not indifferent to the provocations, but they're not, I don't know what your sources grounds for saying about, getting ready for nuclear bunkers. Not at all. I found people were just getting on with life and in a very pleasant, busy way. And I think it's a case of like the West is a finished, is yesterday's kind of empire, and let it go to hell. You know, China, from what I could tell, were quite confident in their own prowess and their own you know, development, and it's quite independent from what the West would like to.
Yeah, but I mean, it is a little bit creepy. I mean, okay, so we make a bit of an obsession here about criticizing our leaders, but you're not allowed to criticize President Xi, apparently, or laugh at the national anthem and things like that. I mean, there is some aspect to the Chinese system which turns their president into a kind of pope, isn't there?
Well, I can't really say anything on that.
Come on, I mean, you as an Irishman must understand the irony of that.
The
infallibility of the leader kind of thing.
Yeah, well, I didn't find anything creepy about being in China. I didn't find it like in any ways close to the caricature that the West would make out, that it's some sort of autocratic iron fist regime. I mean, I didn't see any presence of heavily armed police, none at all, in fact. I mean, I saw civilian police at airports, but I didn't see any form of massive state coercion or kind of like repression or anything like that the West would try to make out. I mean, I just found the society that I saw a large part of was free flowing and just, you know, happily getting on with daily life.
I mean, the obvious thing to say is that people should go and visit China for themselves, see it for themselves.
Tony, of course. I mean, this is the age-old antidote to any kind of misinformation, disinformation, and propaganda. People should go and visit so-called enemies and despotic areas of the world that are alleged to be, and see for themselves. Does their experience match up with the brainwashing and conditioning, the perception management that the Western media are expert at? In my opinion, and from my experience, my observations of China were nowhere in any remote way close to what is alleged in the Western media, with regard to the BRI, the Belt and Road Initiative, Chinese society, China economic development, and indeed their political culture. I didn't see anything that, you know, smacked of any sort of like sinister impact at all in all those areas. If I could just add, Tony, I found it a very refreshing experience where I saw a great culture with a fantastic long history of culture and 5,000 years old civilization. I saw a society, a country, a nation in a modern form, and it was very impressive.
Well, look, for your I think it's around about £1,700 return to Beijing from Heathrow. I think it's well worth it. Anyway, can you just wind up with telling us a bit about how people can find your work? And I know you've written an article about this very topic, about, you know, your experiences using this Belt and Road train system that they've got. And so where do people follow you, Finian?
Well, thanks for giving that a mention, Tony. Yes, there's an article just out today on Strategic Culture Foundation, the online journal, in which I make a brief beginning at trying to report on this BRI. There'll be more reports coming out on that subject in different aspects, but one could get an introduction or an overview of that Pan-Asian rail network in the article that's just out, Strategic Culture Foundation. I would have to, this caveat, Tony, the Western governments in Europe and the United States have banned those kind of websites because it's considered to be deemed to be Russian propaganda. So there you go. You know, our so-called rights to free speech and free access to media are very brutally curtailed. So if people try to go to Strategic Culture Foundation to read about China's BRI in Southeast Asia as it's working out, they may not be able to read that article. Now, you do have to wonder, why is that deemed to be an offensive read or a dangerous read. I will leave the readers or listeners to their own conclusion about the real reason behind why such information is banned by the European Union and the United States.
So is there anywhere, any way to get past that? I mean, I know one very basic, simple thing that works is to download the Tor browser, T-O-R browser, and then you can read it fine.
Well, yeah, there's various these so-called proxy servers. I actually use a Proton mail or Proton VPN is the technical acronym for these proxies that you talk about. The one you mentioned, I'm aware of. There are any number of proxies that you can download for free, and onto your computer, your mobile, your phone, and that those proxies can circumvent Western censorship so that you can read freely websites that I've just mentioned, my article that I just mentioned there. It's a sad state of affairs. I think you would agree that we have to resort to that kind of level of furtiveness to read free independent information. But that's a sign of the times that we're moving into,
isn't it? I mean, this is the accusation that the Western press was throwing at China, that they were doing this. Well, of course, there just also ought to mention that my public inquiry YouTube channel was just being closed down. Now, that had about 25 million views, something like 1500 videos over 15 years, and all sorts of classic documentaries on there. Well, they've just pressed the button, sent that one down the oubliette onto the rocks, and it is no more. So, this is what we're getting in the West now. Is increasingly they're using censorship and character assassination in order to try to control the narrative. Now, that's obviously not a good sign for him, is it? I think maybe pointing towards what you're saying about the death throes of empire.
Yes, I mean, I would even go as far as to say, Tony, I think we're moving into fascism. The Western governments and their crummy capitalist economy is in such desperate straits that it's lending itself to more and more autocratic measures, repressive measures against their citizens, and censorship of media has become such a massive manifestation of that very nefarious kind of rule over the people that I would term like fascism. It's no longer a so-called liberal democracy. I mean, I think we're moving more and more towards a fascist states, and certainly their militarism, NATO, and the reckless drive to war against Russia, against China, is smacks of just fascist power, and without any kind of restraint according to democratic principles. I mean, we're driven here towards a world war situation by madcap and reckless power elites in the West.
Yeah, but for just 1,500, I've just been checking around to look at the prices, £1,500. I mean, obviously there are visas and things to pay for as well. Get yourself over to Beijing, hop yourself onto one of those China trains, and get a view of the other side of the conflict. Fascinating, Finian Cunningham. Thanks very much for joining us.
Oh, well, thanks for having me on, Tony.